You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, at least 21 states were allegedly hacked by Russian cyber attackers during the 2016 election. We'll learn more in a bit.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, a Wisconsin senator raises concerns about his own party's health care plan, a ruling in a police-involved shooting trial, and when is a 4x4 not a 4x4?
Robert Menser is with us now from Wausau. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Rob, U.S. Senate Republicans unveiled a draft of their health care plan yesterday, but Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson joined with what was three is now four other conservative senators raising concerns about that plan. Here he is.
What I've told leadership very clearly is I'm going to need time, and my constituents are going to need time to evaluate exactly how this is going to affect them. So I personally think that holding a vote on this next week would definitely be rushed. I can't imagine, quite honestly, that I'd have the information to evaluate and justify a yes vote within just a week.
What else has Senator Johnson said about his concerns?
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing to say is that Johnson, has the power to hold this up. The Senate Republicans are working on a very tight margin. They have a small majority, and if they lose only a couple of senators, this bill will not pass. So the original plan had been to have the bill, which the draft language was released for the first time on Thursday. We're still waiting on a CBO score for the bill, and the plan originally was to have it voted on next week. So Ron Johnson joined with Senators Ted Cruz of Texas, Mike Lee of Utah, and Rand Paul of Kentucky, some senators on the right flank of the Republican Party, saying that they're not ready to vote yes, and that they think that they need to slow this process down.
And do they all have similar concerns, or are they coming from different perspectives?
Well, so I think it's important to distinguish that group of senators from today. The Senator Dean Heller of Nevada came out saying that he's a no vote on the bill, and sounding very, very against the policy substance of the bill. He talked about millions of people left without coverage and devastating cuts to Medicaid, and the type of language that sounds like it really gets to what the bill would do. Now, Johnson's objection, as you can hear, it's focused a lot more procedurally. And if you look at the joint statement of those senators yesterday, it is actually very weak by the standards of these things. There are a bunch of qualifying language in there. They are not ready to vote for the bill currently. They do want to negotiate. And so they've been quite fairly upfront about putting forward the view that they want to vote for the bill. They won't be doing that next week.
And Senator Johnson has been calling for a repeal of the Affordable Care Act from the start of his first campaign, as have other conservatives in the legislature. But for Johnson, how big an issue is this for him?
Yeah, so it's absolutely. I mean, this has been Ron Johnson's animating issue from the beginning of his political career. That is one of the reasons why it's really hard to imagine, if it really came down to it, is Ron Johnson going to be the guy who prevents this from passing? On the other hand, I mean, the statement that was released, that Johnson and the other senators released yesterday, said that is very frustrating, because it was very hard to pin down on what their objections were. They say that it does not accomplish the most important promise that we made to Americans, to repeal Obamacare and lower their health costs. So it opens up more questions. What counts as repeal? Whose costs are lowered? I mean, both the House bill and the Senate bill make these huge cuts to Medicaid. So by definition, for those people, their costs will be much higher. So it's a bit hard at this point to pin down what the substance of the objection is, or what changes might address it.
And Rob, moving on to a Milwaukee-based story. A jury ruled on Wednesday in the trial of a former Milwaukee police officer in the shooting of Sylville Smith.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Dominique Keegan Brown, not guilty. Signed, the foreperson, dated this 21st day of June.
What was the reaction to this this finding, Rob?
Emotional was the reaction, especially on the part of the family of Sylville Smith. He's a young man who was shot and killed by this former officer. Smith was armed. He had a gun. He was running away from Keegan Brown, the police officer. And this was the case that that triggered protests and riots in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood last year. Another aspect of the aftermath of this case is that Sylville Smith's family essentially immediately following the resolution of the criminal trial announced that they will file a federal civil lawsuit against Smith and against the city of Milwaukee, making the case that he never should have been a police officer in the first place.
And this story has gotten national attention. What have you seen about how it's been covered elsewhere?
Well, this verdict came just a few days after a jury in St. Paul, Minnesota, acquitted a police officer in the fatal shooting of Philando Castile. Just today, a jury deadlocked, and there was a mistrial in a case in Cincinnati, Ohio. So, you know, this case is complicated. The specifics of this case are, you know, they are particular to this case, but it fits into this this broader narrative, and I think what it really highlights is just how difficult it is for charges to be brought against an officer, for a jury to decide against a police officer in a case that involves on-duty behavior.
We're talking with Rob Mensah right now, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's catching us up on the biggest stories out of Wisconsin this week. And Rob, finally, a new lawsuit filed in Northern Illinois takes on Home Depot and the Wisconsin-based chain Menards over what a 4x4 is. Now, on first blush, you think, well, you know, a 4x4 is a 4x4, but some people are alleging that the 4x4s are not actually a 4x4 in measurement, per se.
Oh, they're definitely not. That's not an allegation. 4x4s are not 4x4. That's a fact. So this is a weird one, but this, I can tell you, this story was a big hit this week on the USA Today Network websites. It's hard not to be interested. It's a case of blatant deception and vile trickery. It's a fraud of enormous proportions that's been perpetrated on all of us, Veronica, right under our noses, or at least that's the claim. The thing is, anybody who's ever tried to build like a deck knows that a 4x4 measures 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches. That is the industry standard since forever, that is understood, except that the name is 4x4. So the lawyers in this case are making the claim that is false advertising, and that if you didn't know, if you're not accustomed to building a deck or whatever, then you are being deceived by the name, the trade name 4x4.
Right, and what do the companies involved say to this about the 4x4 scandal going on here?
They say, are you kidding me? What is this real? They say nothing to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter who called and asked for comment. They declined to comment for the news report. But I mean, that's their claim is going to be like, this is a trade name. Just anecdotally, like, ask around. A lot of people will, I guess there's a split, right? If you work with wood, then this is like a fact that you know, and it seems silly to even bring it up. And if you don't work with wood, you're like, wait, what? A 4x4 is 3.5 by 3.5? What's with that?
And what about the false advertising aspect of it? I have not built a deck. I don't know what I would expect. But I mean, if it is not actually a 4x4, then what do you get?
Yeah, it's a little weird, right? I mean, yeah, I don't know how they would have to classify them, like put it in quotes, 4x4 or 4x4 brand lumber, actual measurements 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches. I mean, there are basic expectations for their consumer protections that companies that are selling stuff need to advertise it clearly in a way that even people who are not specialists will understand. So it seems like a little bit of a stretch, and it's certainly funny to talk about. But I guess we'll see how it plays out.
All right, Rob, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, thank you.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Many state election systems were allegedly hacked by Russian hackers during the 2016 election, according to testimony in Congress this week. The revelation means that these attacks were more widespread than previously thought.
While there hasn't been any evidence that votes were changed during the election, hackers were able to hack into software used by poll workers and view a campaign finance database in at least one case.
Tom Kaczmarek joins us now. He's the director of Marquette University's Center for Cybersecurity Awareness and Cyber Defense. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, could you please start by breaking down what the allegations of the cyber attacks are currently? Where does this stand?
Well, there is a lot of secrecy around the details of it, but it appears that there are reports that there were a substantial amount of attempts to exfiltrate information out of databases maintained by states and counties. And some of that was successful in terms of acquiring some information about voter rolls. But as was said in the introduction here, there's little evidence that anything was, that any vote totals were altered. And the voting process is somewhat resilient to these kinds of things because there are some 7,000 different organizations at the local government level that are collecting the voting results and reporting them. So to really disrupt that would mean you'd have to disrupt 7,000 different sites.
Do we know what the end goal of these cyber attacks was?
No, we don't. And the motivation for it is something that there's a lot of speculation about. Some people believe that it is simply to break down confidence in the election system in the United States democracy and somehow make people feel less secure with the government in general. Others may believe it's related to somebody's particular campaign. There is some evidence that some of the information that was stolen may have just been stolen for purposes of identity theft. I mean, when you're stealing records of voters' driver identification and their addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, and things of that nature, those could be elements that are being used just by somebody who wants to steal somebody's identity. So it's always difficult to understand the exact motivation in these cases because we really don't have immediate contact with the people, and it's not clear that there was a financial motive in this case.
Now, voting systems across the United States, they're not standardized. Does that create problems when it comes to having a strong cybersecurity defense?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword. The fact that all of these things are different makes it difficult for somebody to penetrate a significant number of them. There's many different systems out there, right? So if they were all the same, then there might be a possibility that somebody could engineer a hack that would attack all of them. But because they're different, that's much more difficult to do. But on the other hand, it's more difficult to secure them because they're all different, and the security effort would have to go out and check each one of the different systems that are used for security purposes. And there's kind of a separation between the federal authority and the state and county responsibility in the whole election process, so that the federal government can't go in and necessarily interfere with the process used in any county in the nation. There's a separation of responsibility.
Now, intelligence has said that this isn't the first time that there has been attempted interference in elections in the United States by the Russians, but this is a year where it seemed unusually widespread and unusually aggressive. Do we know why that might be?
Well, there are some people who have the theory that this is a process, a long-term process, that some agents are engaged in. And in many of these cybersecurity environments, there's a process of kind of feeling out the space that you want to go into. And each time you try to penetrate a space, you learn a little bit more about it. And over time, you develop an understanding of how to engineer an attack. So it could just be a case that this is a growing effort to gain more information, and it's kind of an escalating process. And so there are people who believe that that's why there is more of it this time than the last election. But it's also a question, I think, of maturation of technology that the cyber criminals and hackers are using. They're getting better at what they do, and hopefully we're getting better at defending.
We're talking to Tom Kaczmarek right now, director of Marquette University's Center for Cybersecurity Awareness and Cyber Defense, talking about news that Russian hackers targeted state election systems in the 2016 election. And Tom, in terms of voting integrity and faith in the well-functioning of our democracy, are you concerned about these cyber attacks? Do you think that they have the potential to destabilize the voting system?
There's always the possibility of that, and within the cybersecurity community, there's always this feeling like if you feel you're secure, you're probably not. So, you know, we do our best and continue to improve our defenses. And as we understand more about the attack vectors, they're called, the ways that hackers attack systems, we build defenses around those. But it's a game between the attackers and the defenders to try and stay out ahead.
Is the United States ready? Do you think that we're in pretty good shape to take on this challenge?
We're in pretty good shape, but we've been somewhat successful. But there's no reason to stop thinking about being alert and enacting policies, procedures, measures, and using technology to shore up our defenses and become better. So we can't be complacent at all, and there are many experts who believe the day will come when something more significant happens, but we do our best to try and stay ahead of it.
What might that something significant look like or be?
Well, the conjecture is that that somebody would just try to sway the election one way or another by attacking voting situations where one particular candidate might be more likely to win the elections in that particular district. Others feel that there might just be a broader attempt to disrupt the whole voting process to, as I think I said earlier, decrease our confidence in the election process.
As far as we know at this point, the cyber attacks came from Russia, and there was Russian meddling at other levels in the election as well. Is Russia the only country that we should be worried about that's on the radar?
Well, certainly the general wisdom seems to be that all countries do some amount of cyber surveillance these days. We hope only bad actors do cyber attacks. And certainly there have been cases that have been attributed to the Russians doing cyber attacks in, for example, the Ukraine, where there was a substantial amount of disruption of society by attacking the infrastructure during the period of conflict between Russia and the Ukraine government.
Given the vulnerabilities that were exposed and the dangers that lie ahead, are there any non-technological measures that you think we should be thinking about when it comes to securing our election systems?
Well, I always, in all my teaching and everything I do, I remind people that we always start with people, then go to process, and then finally use technology. So there's a lot to be done in terms of just making people aware. Most of the breaches that we hear about, and many of those that are associated with this particular flurry of activity, really start with spear phishing. I think you mentioned in the introduction that poll workers were the point of attack for some of these attacks, and the idea is to get credentials out of somebody, and in the cybersecurity world we call that spear phishing, where we have a particular target in mind, and typically it's done by sending a email that disguises who the real sender of the message is and asks the person to take some action which results in them either getting their personal machine infected with malware or obtaining their credentials so that somebody can illegally sign into their accounts on key systems.
And we leave it there. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to help.
That was Tom Kaczmarek, director of Marquette University Center for Cybersecurity Awareness and Cyber Defense. He joined us today to talk about the news that Russian hackers targeted state election systems in the 2016 election. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos announced earlier this week that the online giant will buy the Whole Foods market chain for $13.4 billion. The news rocked the retail world and led to many questions about what it means, not only for those two companies, but for competitors and the public.
Whether or not Amazon is approaching a monopoly in the traditional sense, its increasing reach in a variety of industries and down different supply chains has raised concerns. Lena Kahn is a legal fellow with the Open Markets Program at New America. You can read her New York Times opinion piece on the subject over on the Central Time Facebook page. Lena, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Before we get into the wider issue of Amazon and monopoly power, how big a deal is it? Amazon trying, they need approval, federal approval, to purchase Whole Foods.
I think it's quite significant for a couple of reasons. I mean, you know, it's true that in the grocery sector itself, the combined entity of Amazon and Whole Foods would only have, you know, less than 5% of the market. So from a market share point, it's not significant. But if we look at, if we consider the possibilities of how Amazon could use its dominance in online markets to kind of expand into the physical space and then also use the physical retail to amplify its online power, I think that's where we start seeing some of the potential concerns. In addition to the fact that you know, Amazon has a history of entering markets and then engaging in predatory ways, so that, you know, competitors can no longer compete on a level playing field.
Yeah, can you talk more about that? How Amazon leverages some of its advantages to gain this competitive big advantage over a lot of different sectors now.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, one of the issues with Amazon is that it is oftentimes both a platform for other companies and then also competing with those companies. So, you know, it is both a seller of all sorts of goods as well as hosting other companies that are selling these goods. And one thing that other sellers and producers have noted is that Amazon kind of uses its platform to spot other products and goods that are selling well, and then it will kind of use that data and information to then directly compete with those other retailers and sellers, go head to head with them, undercut them on price, and kind of, you know, expand its own sales at their expense. So this is a way in which you see that, you know, Amazon, the fact of Amazon being integrated across different sectors allows it to use kind of one sector to privilege another line of business. I think this is also a concern when it comes to potential discrimination discrimination or disfavoring. So in the grocery sector, you know, if Amazon is both, you know, selling groceries and also has this huge logistics and delivery infrastructure, is there a possibility that when it would come to other grocers also seeking to use its delivery mechanism, Amazon would, you know, favor its own groceries and kind of give those privileged speed and kind of discriminate against others? So I think these are the kinds of concerns that crop up when we see one entity being as integrated across different spheres as Amazon is.
When we think of Amazon, I think the first thing we think of course, is buying stuff online. How dominant is Amazon when it comes to online purchasing?
It's by far the most dominant online retailer. It enjoys 43% of all online sales. I think something like 50% of all Americans begin online shopping on Amazon's platforms. Its revenues are more than the revenues of its next 10 online competitors combined. So it's really positioned with a lot of dominance at this stage, and I think only positioned to grow. It has 80 million Prime members, and studies show that once somebody joins into the Prime program, they're significantly less likely to look at a competitor's goods. I think it's something like 99% of Prime members don't even look at competing retailers.
We're talking to Lena Khan from the Open Markets Program at New America, looking at Amazon's attempt to purchase Whole Foods Market and Amazon's power in so many sectors now of the U.S. and world economy. And Lena, in a recent piece, you said, hey, we have to use the word monopoly here. And it's not what people might think of traditionally when they think of a monopoly of one, I don't know, car company dominating the market or something like that. What do you mean when you say Amazon is becoming a monopoly?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think the more precise term here is Amazon has monopsony power. So monopsony is when a single company is the only or, you know, one of the very few sellers or one of the very few buyers of other people's goods. So, for example, today, if you're an independent retailer and you're looking to sell on the internet, for the most part, you really have to be on Amazon. You know, given the so many consumers, you rely on Amazon as a one-stop shop. A lot of producers and retailers that are looking to sell online have to rely on Amazon's platform. And so Amazon has enormous power over those producers and retailers, and I think is able to use that power to, you know, extract better terms, but also in potential abusive ways, especially when we see those conflicts of interest. That said, you know, I think it is true that Amazon does not meet the very traditional definition of a monopoly, but I think online markets in some ways are the pandemics of online markets, I think, invite us to rethink how we understand monopoly or dominance. You know, with network effects, a lot of online markets are winner-take-all. So that's why we also see a company, you know, it become logical for a company to pursue growth over profits. And so, you know, you see Amazon aggressively investing, you see it pricing below cost in order to chase market share, because it understands that once it achieves a certain level of market share, it's possible for a market to kind of tip in its favor.
You make an analogy with another business from history that grew in kind of unprecedented ways to unprecedented scales and had this kind of power to charge whatever they wanted, eventually the railroad industry in the 19th century. And this was something that, you know, the government regulators had no experience with at the time, similar to Amazon. Can you spell out that analogy a little more?
Sure. So, yeah, during the Industrial Revolution, we saw the advent of railroads. Railroads, in many ways, you know, conferred a lot of benefits on producers and suppliers who now could take their goods and reach all sorts of other markets. But railroads were natural monopolies, and so oftentimes you saw this similar dynamic where all of these farmers and producers were reliant on the railroad, and the railroad could discriminate among them. It could charge abusive fees and kind of exploit that power. And so what we did was we passed the Interstate Commerce Act in 1887. And that law introduced a regime of common carriage. It basically required equal and fair access and said that, you know, if we're going to enjoy these railroads, if we're going to enjoy these railroads, we have to require that they not be able to use their power in discriminatory ways. And so I think we're seeing an analogous dynamic with Amazon now, where it has built out so much infrastructure, not just at the online platform level, but also at the physical delivery level. I mean, Amazon has a huge number of warehouses across the country. It has huge capacity when it comes to trucks. It's kind of looking to expand into shipping, into drones. And this is also true when it comes to cloud computing. So Amazon is a leader in the cloud server space and is also dominant there. So I think, you know, I think it's useful to think of Amazon not purely as a retailer, but also as an infrastructure company. And I think we actually have had a lot of experience thinking about infrastructure companies and how to ensure that, the infrastructure benefits the public and is not exploited by a single company.
So would that law potentially apply to Amazon, where if Rob's online groceries and Lena's online groceries and Whole Foods now owned by Amazon, Amazon would have to treat in some ways similarly?
Exactly. So if you had a similar regime for Amazon, there would be limits on how much Amazon, or, you know, Amazon would have to grant us all equal access up to a certain degree. It would not be able to kind of pick and choose winners.
Now, getting back to this Whole Foods purchase, as I mentioned, as I understand it anyway, this is not a done deal. Federal regulators would have to sign off on this, in part over antitrust and monopoly issues. Do you think they should reject Amazon's attempt to purchase Whole Foods?
I think they should block the deal. I think, you know, we're at an inflection point with online commerce, and I think there's a lot of potential for Amazon to use its, say, Prime memberships to bundle all sorts of services and to enhance its online power. I think, you know, this is an area that Amazon had been investing in. You know, it had been looking to get into the grocery and delivery space, and if we allow it to purchase Whole Foods, we're basically allowing it to buy its way into being a player in this market, as opposed to competing its way into being a player in this market. And, you know, generally, antitrust law looks disfavorably upon growth by acquisition by a dominant firm seeking to, you know, use its existing dominance to gain a major foothold in an adjacent industry. And so I think this is a case that would require scrutiny and skepticism from enforcers. I think it's also worth thinking about, you know, what would potential entry look like? You know, can you imagine companies looking to go head to head with an integrated entity like Amazon in the grocery space or in the delivery markets for groceries? Antitrust law is supposed to preserve competition, not just in a static sense, but also in a dynamic sense, kind of looking more at the long term. And so I think when you consider those forms of concerns, the harm that would result from this merger are a lot more apparent.
We're talking with Lena Khan about Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods, what it means for consumers and the economy as whole, and Amazon's dominant position in online retail and other stuff now, too. Lena is a legal fellow with the Open Markets Program at New America.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the news of this merger? And are you concerned about a company getting such a strong foothold in so many aspects of the economy? Or do you think that will make things more efficient and maybe less expensive? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the implications of Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods. Lena Khan is a legal fellow with the Open Markets Program at New America. She wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times called Amazon Bites Off Even More Monopoly Power.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you shop at Whole Foods? Do you shop via Amazon? Do you think that the combination of the two will help or hurt you as a consumer? In general, what do you think of the growth of Amazon? Is it convenient to you, or do you see it affecting the economy, maybe consumers in a bad way? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Lena, isn't there an argument that people are voting with their dollars? Amazon is providing the convenience they want, and ultimately their growth is helping consumers?
Absolutely. I think it's undeniable that Amazon has served consumers extremely well and has brought enormous benefits to consumers. But I think it's worth remembering that, you know, traditionally our anti-monopoly laws did not only consider the effects on consumers, we also considered the effects on producers and suppliers, we considered the effects on entrepreneurs, we considered how, you know, a company's dominance was affecting our democracy, our communities. And so I think, you know, there are potential costs to Amazon's dominance. I think it's also worth recalling that, you know, even though in some ways Amazon is as dominant as it is because consumers have, you know, kind of flocked to it, there are other ways in which Amazon has, in fact, used its power in predatory ways and has reached its level of dominance through competing on an unlevel playing field. You know, it didn't have to pay sales tax for a large, for several years. And I think there are other ways in which, you know, by virtue of being both a platform and competing with the companies that are depending on its platform, there's a kind of uneven playing field. And so I think it's also worth questioning, even if we may be enjoying Amazon's dominance because it results in lower prices for us right now, what are the long-term costs of that? And are we as a society willing to incur those costs?
Let's go to our callers now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. A problem I see is Amazon and other big companies do not pay local taxes. They do not contribute to us fixing our streets. Our streets are deteriorating. We need to support local businesses that pay local taxes.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Amazon, that has changed some, hasn't it, that local and state tax issue, Lena?
It has, yeah, exactly. There are many states have adopted regimes that now require Amazon to pay taxes. I think, you know, I agree fully with Dennis, and I think this goes back to what I was saying earlier. You know, the cheapness of consumer goods is not the only dimension on which we should be assessing the dominance of companies. You know, a lot of main streets have suffered. And I think, you know, oftentimes people think that the reason that a lot of our main streets are suffering is purely a technology issue, that it's just, you know, all of this innovation and progress has brought us Amazon, and that's why all of these stores are suffering. But I think it's important to distinguish power issues from technology issues, and I think there are ways in which we could have a flourishing online economy, but also ensure that, you know, that is not synonymous with one company capturing an outsized share of online commerce. So I think it's important to separate kind of the benefits of technology from the questions of how power is distributed in our political economy. And, you know, on Dennis's point, I would highly recommend the work of a group called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and that's produced a terrific report looking at the cost and of Amazon when it comes to our local streets and kind of local communities.
Dennis, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Nicole with us in Sheboygan. Nicole, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, pretty much I think that Amazon has built itself as an empire, and I admire them for it, you know? They probably worked very, very hard to get where they're at. So why should we penalize them for it?
Nicole, thanks for the call. So, Lena, Amazon, hard work. It's a success story. Let them keep rolling.
It's a great point, and it's true that Amazon has, you know, undertaken a lot of risks, undertaken a lot of pursued a lot of innovation to get to where it is. I think a couple of things. I think, again, there are aspects of its conduct that have been predatory and abusive, that it's kind of, you know, exploited certain conflicts of interest to become as dominant as it is today. But I'd also note that, you know, there have been numerous examples throughout American history where we have both appreciated the fruits of technology and innovation that have been wrought by, you know, private companies, but also realize that in order for the public to enjoy these technologies, we need to kind of rebalance power, and that, you know, oftentimes technologies can be used to concentrate power and control away from local communities. And we have taken active steps to, you know, change our laws to ensure that these technologies are enjoyed more broadly by the public. So I think it is absolutely true that in many ways Amazon has gotten to where it is from innovation. But I think it's also true that there are certain ways in which that its technologies and its concentration of control could be harming us that we as citizens might decide is undesirable. And I think we as citizens are entitled to, you know, to consider that and consider whether we need to address this problem.
Nicole, thanks for calling. We're talking to Lena Khan from New America. She's with the Open Markets Program there, looking at Amazon. They're big, getting bigger now with a proposed purchase of Whole Foods Market, and they're getting big in a non-digital way. They would own a bunch of actual physical brick-and-mortar stores. Back to our callers, Sam with us now in Madison. Sam, hi.
Hi, how are you? Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, so I moved here from the Pacific Northwest. I had a lot of friends who worked for Amazon in Washington. A lot of them had concerns about, you know, how they treat their employees, you know, whether or not they give them enough hours, you know, things like that. My main concern, though, is now that they're making this huge merger is automation. You know, as technology is going to continue to grow and, you know, they're going to start replacing, you know, people with, you know, computers and everything else like that, how it's going to really affect the workforce.
Sam, thanks for the call. And Amazon, famous for its automated warehouses. Lena, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think this is an issue that we need to, you know, consider not just with regards to Amazon, but more generally with it's a the topic of automation and how it's going to affect our workforce, I think, is a really big one. You know, I think Amazon has showed a penchant for being ruthlessly efficient, which, again, has, you know, on the one hand, enabled them to deliver us very cheap consumer goods. But I think the caller was exactly right to highlight the potential effects on workers. You know, even short of automation and the risks of that, we've heard stories of how, you know, in its warehouses, Amazon has treated its workers. That, you know, there was that terrific report from Allentown, Pennsylvania, where Amazon actually had a warehouse, but it had ambulances kind of standing outside on hand because it knew that it's the conditions in its warehouse were so hot and were so unbearable that, you know, some workers were passing out. And so I think it's definitely worth remembering that how a dominant company treats its workers is also, you know, another aspect of concentration and consolidation. And I should say more generally, you know, the fact of consolidation across our economy more generally has made it more difficult for workers to switch jobs. You know, there's been a lot of reporting showing the rise of non-compete agreements, which limit, you know, the ability of a worker working for one employer to then go take his labor and work for someone else. So it's, you know, ironic that as companies are becoming more consolidated, they're also limiting competition among their workers in ways that end up depressing wages.
Sam, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Deanna in Pewaukee. Deanna, hi.
Hi. I would like to respond to the idea that there has been any benefit to somebody like Amazon coming down to the consumer. If all you think about is the price of a product, you might be able to argue that in the short term. I don't think you can in the long term, but even in the short term, we're not getting better products. But you know, we're not getting cheaper products or better products at a cheaper price. We're just getting cheaper products. It's not just Amazon doing that. But beyond that, it's harder to find unique items because the big boxes have dominated retail so much. And they're all trying to carry the products at the big margins.
Gotcha. Deanna, I had to jump in. Lena, briefly, ultimately, if we have too much power in the hands of one company, maybe fewer valid choices for us to make.
That's an excellent point, and I think the effects on diversity and quality is another major way in which, you know, monopsony power, as I was saying, can have detrimental effects. I mean, I think, you know, when you have a powerful company that's squeezing suppliers and producers, that means those suppliers and producers have less to be able to invest in new products and new ideas. And so I think that's, you know, definitely a major worry here.
Lena, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Lena Khan is a legal fellow with the Open Markets Program at New America. You can find her New York Times opinion piece called Amazon Bites Off Even More Monopoly Power. We have that linked on the Central Time Facebook page.